Yes, so most of you are probably thinking the talk is the highlight of the meeting. But actually, what I'm trying to encourage is actually what we just did. That is so much more important than anything I have to say. Any peace, any stillness, clears your mind. And you can see for yourself the truth that the Buddha was pointing to. Right? Obviously, some reading, some learning is it's good, certainly a very good start. But the end of the path, that can't take you. The reading, the learning can't take you to the end of the path. It's only through meditation, through a peaceful mind, that you can see, can feel, can experience what what the Buddha did, what the enlightened masters did over the ages, right? Having said that, we will go through and list all the spiritual qualities that you can be developing. It's a way to kind of, pursue a higher path of happiness, path of harmlessness. And also for all the terrible things people say that the internet is causing, it makes you very distracted and all this other stuff. But I forgot to write it down, so I Googled the 10 spiritual qualities, and it came up. So there you go. Okay, so there are 10. Obviously, most people probably know. I'll list them, the 10, and then go just really pick the a few that are not so well known, that are not so popular, right? So it starts out with dana, which is, generosity. Most people know what that means. It's giving. But there are different levels. You can give things. You can offer, services. Obviously, you donate material stuff. But also, you can also, a deeper kind of dana is offer forgiveness, right? Someone does you something wrong. Sometimes it's easy to give people things, but then they say something wrong, they annoy you, and then you hold that a long time. So forgiveness is also kind of a form of charity. Giving people the benefit of the doubt. So it's a way to kind of look at dana. So there's many ways to kind of practice generosity other than just, writing a check and putting it into the donation box. You can do, a lot more. Sila, most Buddhists would know that. Sila is harmlessness, to keeping a level morality. That's pretty popular. Next one is renunciation, nekama. So that's probably good to spend some time on because it's not one of the better known qualities that people talk about. We all talk about dana, and then or meditation or wisdom, but a good way to focus on is nekama, is renunciation, especially in the Buddhist, kind of this consumer context. We've been raised and conditioned, to always, get more things. Happiness, lies in getting, a new car, getting a good job. Right, you're looking for good jobs, getting, what you want. Acquiring things, getting a new iPhone, a new video games. But, so in this kind of culture, restraint, a renunciation is not something we want to focus on. And sometimes, it's interesting to focus on that. It's actually, sometimes to give things up is actually bring another level of happiness. Sometimes it's the restraint also, helps us to focus the mind. Because sometimes when we have many things in the mind, when we have many things to look after, we get very distracted. It keeps us very busy. But renunciation, so that's why sometimes it's good to focus on going to a meditation center or a monastery. Because there, the focus is on the renunciation. You have to keep, the 8 precepts. You can't eat in the afternoon. No music. Celibacy. Not talking so much. So it tends to kind of focus the mind a little bit. We also, by going to a different place, we are going outside of our comfort zone. Sometimes we surround ourselves with things we like. You know, music, you eat food, whatever food you like, wear whatever you like, you sit, sleep next to the people you like. Sometimes just going outside of our comfort zone strengthen the muscles that a lot of times when we're comfortable, it doesn't get developed. It's the muscles of patient endurance, the muscles of kind of bearing with unpleasant things, bearing things that, not getting what we want. And because living in this, very comfortable society in Australia, we generally get what we want. And the mind is sometimes a bit flabby. So one way to train the mind is to build up some kind of a resistance to being in situation, doing things that you may not normally do, right? So that is, but also it goes together. Nekama is renunciation, but also the other qualities that go together is kanti, which is patient endurance. You know, these days and age, we want everything yesterday. You know, you want your car, you want your iPhone, you want it right away. And so we don't have a lot of patience. And then sometimes we bring that into the spiritual practice as well. You know, I want my enlightenment, then I want to write a book, and then I want to go on and get married, have kids, and do everything. All in one weekend, right? And the people will come. As a monk, they always come. They're like, you know, Ajahn. Yes, yes, yes. I know the Buddha took 5 years, but, you know, he was Indian. You know, he didn't go to university. He was the first one, so he had to kind of fumble around. But, Buddhism has been around for 2,600 years. You know, we got very good education these days. You know, can you tell me a shortcut? You know, cut this out. Okay. I only have one weekend, Ajahn. This is enlightenment. I got to go back and do other stuff, right? I got to get a good degree. So we get very impatient. We want things right away. And it brings a certain amount of suffering as well. Also, but then we don't have the patience to kind of wait for things to naturally come by themselves. And as the Buddha, has taught over and over again, as many monks and nuns who sit up there and tell you, craving, desire is the root of suffering, root of stress. So the practice really is about, a bit of letting go, a bit of patience. And this idea of, when you're sitting in meditation, you're not looking for the jhanas, you're not looking for the light, not looking for anything, just being there. And you'll find that, as you are happy in the present moment, you're content, you find that the mind settles down on its own. Settles down on its own. And sometimes it won't settle down because you had a busy day. But it's just this idea of, sitting and waiting. Waiting the moment. Because, all the happiness, all the respect, all the love, all the good stuff that you want from the world, from life, it's already here. The only thing we need to do is just to wait long enough for these things to come to us. Wait long enough for the mind to open up. And you realize, all the chasing, the running around, the managing, manipulating, the yearning for all the good things. We've been running in the wrong direction. Just the waiting. You want your perfect partner, you don't have to go to an internet dating, you don't have to go to the bars, you just have to sit and be comfortable with yourself, be comfortable with the present moment, be comfortable with, I may have to live a single life for the rest of my life, but that's okay, I'm just happy being who I am. Then all of a sudden, he or she comes along. You never know. So this is waiting, while this running around searching, sometimes it's creating more problems, actually. So next time when you're at home, when you finish after the talk, just reflect on your patient endurance. And that's the Buddhist exact word, actually. Patient endurance is the highest austerity. We might think fasting, going without sleep, doing all these kind of very difficult things. It's the way of a spiritual warrior, right? I can sit without moving for 3 hours or whatever, or 10 hours. I can sit out in the snow. I can do all sorts of things. But the Buddha never said that those kind of austerities, practices are essential, that you need them for enlightenment, actually. But he said many times over and over again, also Ajahn Chah, many times over and over again, that patient endurance is the way to conquer our defilements, the way to conquer the desires in our mind. Because so much of it comes from this sense of, this outflow of the mind, this energy that, wants to get some things, wants to be somebody, something in the future, be a better person, but be something, do something. So much of it. So just by waiting around, you are going against the grain. Yeah. Because even Ajahn Chah, as a young monk, he had many kind of, obstructions, many obstacles to his monk life. He had a lot of, he would sit as a young monk. And during that time, because obviously there were very strict kind of rules regarding food, absolutely nothing to eat after 12. And the old days, you didn't have much dark chocolate, cheese, or whatever that we have in the monasteries these days. It was just pretty much hot water. So he would get really hungry, right? So he would, every afternoon meditation, he was very one-pointed. He'd say, why focus? His only focus of meditation is bowl of noodle. You think bowl of noodle, bowl of noodle. So I thought about bowl of noodle for many years. And you know, and then later he got over the bowl of noodles, he started thinking about girls. Yeah. And then I said, you know, wow, you know, how did you endure, like, you know, those difficulties in the early years? And he said, you know, it wasn't anything special. He just said, you know, patient endurance, just kind of being with it, and just, you know, okay, you know, just not making more of a problem, just being with it. Eventually, these energy that come up during the practice, eventually they fade on their own. Because sometimes, you know, when we meet something, we think, you know, I should kind of, you know, buckle down. I should use all my might and muscles to kind of blast through this, you know, obstacles, to blast through this confusion or whatever. But I think in the spiritual practice, you've been long enough, you probably hear, you know, out in the world, I might say, when the going gets tough, right, the tough gets going. Exert more energy and more power. But in the you know, kind of a spiritual search, you say, you know, when the going gets tough, right, the tough stand still. You stand there, you look, you investigate, you try to understand. Wisdom is so much more powerful than willpower. Wisdom, clarity of the mind, has this kind of purity on its own power. And then when you see where your attachment is, you understand. And the wonderful thing is that then your attachment, the confusions fade away on their own. You're not in there trying to push things away, you're not in there trying to clear things. When you understand, when you have true wisdom, these problems that you had, you thought you had, these terrible things that you thought you might be facing, they melt away on their own. Right? So that leads to wisdom faculty. Right? Wisdom, in Buddhism, it's nothing else, it's really about wisdom. This, and then wisdom is not just pure knowledge, it's this kind of experiential experience that you see clearly into the nature of reality. And when you see clearly into the nature of reality, you know, your suffering fades away. Happiness happens. But it's not something, you, like I said, you can read from a book or get from a lecture. You know, it's like the wisdom is like a good simile for wisdom. It's like, Ajahn Chah said, it's like the taste of durian, right? You're not Asian, you don't know what is that taste is like. It's very special. It's not really like apple. It's like, what does it taste like? You never taste it. It's like apple. It's kind of sweet. Like watermelon, not really. Like a grape, not really. It's hard to difficult, you know, to describe it. It's like, okay, well, I suppose you're in Europe somewhere reading about what's durian. So you, you know, you want to find out what's the taste of durian like. So you start to read, you Google it, shows you the picture of what durians look like. You can see what, you know, the trees, the different types of durian you might get. You know, the different trees that, you know, the leaves look like, the variety. You see when it's a seed. You see the trees look like when it's a young tree and how it develops. You know, and then you, after a while, you're reading many books on, you know, different types of durians, what the uses are, how to grow them, what kind of fertilizer it uses. And you've been, you know, you want to find more and more, but you don't have to, you know, you don't have the opportunity to taste the durian. You want to find more about it, so you keep reading on it. You read many books on how to, you know, take care of a durian, how to grow it, and pretty soon, you know, you become an expert at durian. You know how, you know, because you read, you know, how to, you know, look after a durian tree, what kind of fertilizer, kind of climate, how much it is. And you begin, sometimes you can write books about it as well. but you haven't tasted durian, you still don't know, right? It's the same with reading it. No matter, you know, we read, how many books you read on Dhamma, and how many lectures you go to, unless, you know, you sit down in meditation, it's very hard to know what the Buddha is talking about. So saying, unless you bite into a durian, you never know its taste. And reading the books gets you closer. You know, like you said, durian is not an apple. It's not an orange. You know, it's kind of buttery. It's kind of, you know, smells kind of, some people say sweet. Some people say kind of pungent, kind of smelly. It's all sorts of things. So it's getting closer. But it's still, you know, you don't know exactly what it is. It's the same with the wisdom of what the Buddha is pointing to. You know, reading, listening to talks, hearing what the meditation masters have to say about, you know, the enlightenment experience, as seen to the nature of reality, you know, points you in the right direction. But you still haven't tasted, you still don't know what wisdom is like. It's only through clear, still, a bright mind that you can taste what the Buddha is talking about when he says peace. What the Buddha is talking about when he said, you know, like, peace is the highest happiness. Contentment is the highest happiness. What does it mean? Like, well, I think iPhone is better. Having ice cream is better. No, when you start to meditate, you see, peace is something very precious, very rare in the world, but something that we all have the potential to touch, something that we all can have access to anytime and anywhere, if we turn our mind to it, if we turn our mind inward to the body, turn our mind inward to the present moment, turn our mind inward to the breath. But we keep looking outside, and we're forever searching for the happiness, searching. And it's like I said, it's all here. Just have to kind of sit, relax, take a deep breath, and allow things to open up. So that's wisdom. Okay, what's the other one to talk about? Going through the list, virya, which is mean energy, to talk about continuity, satya is truthfulness. So that, obviously, you know, is pretty straightforward. Everybody values truthfulness. We don't want to be misled, lied to. So obviously, we want to extend the same courtesy to other people. Not tell them lies, not try to cheat them or misrepresent them. So satya marmi is also something that's good to cultivate on a spiritual path. The other two mental qualities to develop, and most of you probably be familiar with, is metta, obviously, this kind of friendliness, kind-heartedness, loving-kindness that we can develop towards ourselves and others. But the other one that may not be so familiar is upekkha, equanimity. Sometimes it can be misunderstood. A lot of people say, oh, yes, I'm Buddhist, I'm just economist about everything, right? As a monk, we're supposed to be economists. Just give me what give me whatever, and we can't say it's good or bad. We just eat it and smile, whatever. Some people think, I'm practicing Buddhist, I can do the same. anything you say, yes, I'm economist, I don't feel anything. Economist is different than indifference, right? Equanimity is a quality that comes from having a still mind, that comes from wisdom as well. There's a large measure of wisdom involved in equanimity, in the sense that you are poised, you're still, and you're ready to help. But because of the present situation, let's say you had an argument with your friend, you still have, love towards this person, you have that towards kindness, but you know that, at this time, it's not the right time to go and to interact with them because they're not in the right space. So you wait. Not because you had a fight, you say, I don't want anything to do with them, whatever what she's doing, I don't care anymore. I'm equanimous. No. It's more like, I still care, but I know it's not the good time, and I wait. And whenever the opportunity arises, then you interact from kindness and compassion. But until then, you wait. You don't get depressed over it. You don't try and, kind of practice indifference. But you don't try to be, to push the other person away. But so you wait. But also you understand, with wisdom, understanding the law of karma, that we are our inherit. Sometimes you see a lot of wisdom, a lot of suffering in the world, and you want to help. And some people get overwhelmed by the large amount of injustice, suffering that we see around us sometimes. You read the newspaper, acts of violence, of rape, of, whatever, mistreatment of the immigrants, and all sorts of things that are not so inspiring. But it's important for our mental training, it's important that we do steer the mind towards equanimity. And that we help people where we can. But we don't dwell in the negativity of the world around us. Because dwelling on negativity just also kind of weakens your mind, makes you a bit more depressed, you have less energy, and then and you find that you can't deal with your own difficulties, your own challenges in life. So knowing that, we always steer the mind, you always think, okay, I help where I can. But also look after yourself. Look after your own mental clarity, happiness. Because, the kind of basic Buddhist kind of philosophy is that unless you're happy, unless you're peaceful, You can't give that to others. You can't give what you don't have. So sometimes you see the people in the health industry sometimes. You know, they have this kind of burnout. Because you help people every day and then sometimes you get overwhelmed by the amount of suffering, overwhelmed by the amount of kind of, you know, sickness in the world. But also, you know, always to conserve your energy, to learn to relax, learn to slow down, and look after your own mind and heart. And see, you know, keep that, you know, this kind of calm, but clarity. But also, you know, just kind of feel, you know, how am I, you know, in terms of the compassion in your heart every day. Is it maintained? Is it strong? Is it bright? Or you're feeling, you know, worn out, feeling tired, feeling, you know, kind of rushed, feeling a bit harassed. So always kind of, from time to time, steer the mind towards equanimity. Allow some space, some time to slow down, to relax, to recollect, and to rebuild the inherent energy in your own mind. So that is the quality of upeka. And also understanding, you know, it's the law of karma. We help where we can. Law of karma is not a justification for, you know, something bad happened to you. Oh, you last lifetime, you must have hurt a Buddha or something. You must have punched an arahant. That's why you got beaten today. That's not how karma works, and it's not helpful. You know, we've all generated lots of good and bad karma in the past life. So when you see your friends or people around you who are experiencing moments of difficulties, then the helpful response, regardless of what happened in the past, is compassion and care. Because, you know, always to reflect it, you know, that's what we would like for people to respond. You know, when you're in trouble, when you're down, you know, some compassion, some care. So sometimes, you know, we, some Buddhists can say that, you know, we meet somebody who's in trouble, oh, you know, don't worry about that. She just, you know, it's her bad karma. She's, you know, doing this or this is happening to her. Yeah, the karma of having a body, the karma of living in the world is sometimes, you know, these unfortunate things happen. Sometimes you're born with, you know, a painful, a disease that you inherit. Sometimes you're born into a kind of unfortunate family situation. Well, you know, the father and the mother doesn't look after you or something. Yeah. So accepting that, yeah, it's the nature of the world that these things happen from time to time. But we can always, you know, we can always do something. We can always have a positive influence on the people and the world around us. We always can care. Even if we can't do anything, we always can offer us empathy, offer care and compassion to the world around us. So it's not, you know, understanding, reflecting on the law of karma is not an excuse for inaction. But remember, we have to act with wisdom. Compassion doesn't always carry. You know, looking around, kind of from the, see the examples in the world. Sometimes people are, you know, have a lot of energy and they want to change the world, but sometimes they make a mess of it around us. One of the good things, you know, not to say that it's just the fault that can happen to anybody, but, you know, 30, 40 years ago or whatever, you see this whole, you know, there was an idea that we should take the kids, the Aboriginal kids, away from their family to give them education, right? And now, you know, and that was from, you know, maybe a good idea, but not from wisdom. Because you're taking, you know, people from the families who they loved and want to be around, and then, you know, that, and then these kids suffered as a result of this kind of misguided policy that sometimes we don't see clearly. So it's important that any action, compassion, is coupled with wisdom, coupled with sensitivity. You know, let's ask the people, you know, do they really need help? Instead of, you know, kind of forcing our views on others. So sometimes wisdom is an important thing to cultivate. And it only comes through having a still mind, having the sensitivity to understand yourself and understand others around you. So that is roughly the 10 spiritual qualities you develop as a Buddhist or as any practitioner. And remember, you know, kind of life is just always about developing different qualities of the mind. You know, we are developing different habits as we live in the world. Sometimes those habits are wholesome, sometimes they're unwholesome. So these 10 kind of, there are many ways to look at spiritual qualities. These 10 are just kind of a perspective. There are other, you know, obviously the Buddhas had different kind of teachings regarding different, you know, spiritual faculties that you could develop. But the main thing is to be sensitive to what your mind is doing, sensitive to what your heart, whatever habits you're in, whatever, you know, intention or thoughts you have, always reflect inward. You know, is this wholesome or is this unwholesome? And steer your mind towards wholesome qualities. So that's the reason why we have the big list, practicing generosity, harmlessness, practicing renunciation where you can, virya energy, rousing the energy to do things. Kanti, patient endurance, that I talked about. Satya is truthfulness. Aditana is determination. And some of these are, like I said, you know, they're just not spiritual qualities. They have a world application that we can, you know, kind of apply. And, you know, as a student, you know, determination is important to get yourself through. Sometimes you don't want to do your homework, but, you know, okay, just, you know, sometimes you don't want to do this term paper. You want to run around, you know, go to the pub. But a bit focused, you know, and so that helps as well. Because I remember as a working in the banking industry, you know, yeah, okay, it fosters lots of greed, obviously, and a lot of, you know, other unwholesome qualities, being in a very competitive environment. So that's not so great. But being in a professional environment also cultivate certain qualities that you can also help to further your spiritual quest. And one of that is patient endurance. You know, you don't get to choose the people you work with. They're really obnoxious. They're really demanding. And you can't change them. So you're like, okay, yeah, you know. I get paid a lot of money. I can do whatever. I can deal with this person 8 hours a day. It doesn't matter. That's okay. Go home, collect my check, and that's okay. Or you can focus on, you know, being professional. I don't have to like you, but we can still work on this project. Right? So there are. So sometimes determinations, you know, I'm going to show up every day at 7, leave at 5. Sometimes you feel sick. Sometimes you don't feel like it, but, you know, you get up and you do it. So those are the qualities that certainly help you in the worldly sense, but also helps you when you are cultivating a spiritual path. In the monastery, it's the same way. We have morning chanting, 5 o'clock. Sometimes you feel like it, you go show up. Sometimes you don't feel like it, still have to show up, right? The next time on the retreat, I'm going to counting. And so this idea of just, you know, once you focus on something, yeah, just, you know, just do it, whether you feel like it or not. Ajahn Chah's kind of famous advice to young monks. You know, when you're really happy, inspired, when your meditation is really going great and you're getting bliss out, yes, you know, meditate. That's right. Things are going well. Just meditate. And when you're fed up, you don't want to get out of bed, you hate Ajahn Chah, you hate the Buddha, you hate everybody else around you, what should I do, Ajahn? Still meditate. And that's the thing, just kind of consistency. When you feel great, meditate. You don't feel like it, just meditate as well. And that's the thing that, you know, and that it does kind of build up the muscles of endurance, builds up the muscles of determination, builds up a spiritual qualities that you can use in the lay world as well as when you're meeting with difficulties. You know, just keeping things going, not giving to your moods of, you know, despair. You're still going to show up. You're still going to do whatever it is. And no matter what's happening inside, that way it doesn't, you know, you doesn't get distracted to the different emotional pools you might get into when we get, you know, when we're not focused. So determination is one of the important spiritual qualities to develop. And the other ones, you know, metta, upeka, and also panya, wisdom. Remember, wisdom is not something that we can will into existence. Sometimes something we can read about or inferred. Wisdom, from a Buddhist perspective, is experiential, something that you realize in yourself. The Buddha can't give it to you, Ajahn Chah can't hand it to you. All they can do is kind of point, encourage you to practice, and then you can see for yourself what he's talking about. Yeah? So those are the 10 spiritual qualities that offer your reflections today. Okay. Any questions or comments?
How do you differentiate between mental and spiritual quality, and is meditation the surest way to attain it?
I think Buddhism, mental, spiritual, about the same. Because the dichotomy in Buddhist kind of philosophy is really between mental and physical. Yeah. So mental, spiritual, roughly about the same. And in terms of meditation, yes, meditation is the heart of Buddhism, the core. You can do lots of chanting. You can prostrate until your knee bleeds. You chant till your throat is coarse. Unless you sit down, be quiet, and close your eyes for about 5 minutes, you're not going to understand, you're not going to realize what the Buddha was talking about in the books.
So the chanting is below meditation?
Below is kind of, people don't like it, right? With this guru, everything's equal. Not really. Chanting is also, depends, it's a preparation. Because chanting also calms the mind. And also it's, preparation in the sense that it calms the mind down, you focus on the word, and also it directs your mind towards qualities of the Buddha, qualities of devotion. Because sometimes you have a very busy day, you're running around, you just had an argument with your girlfriend, and you sit down, it's very hard to focus on the breath. So chanting is a way to kind of slow things down and inclines the mind towards wholesome qualities. So it is an integral part. And some people, but it's true. If you just chant and you never sit down, you only experience a certain amount of peace, but not the deep peace of silence.
So wisdom can only be attained by meditation and not by chanting.
Yes. Yeah. Hope I don't offend our chanting lineage. Yes.
You spent a lot of your formative years on the West Coast.
Yeah.
How did that affect your approach to your journey towards Buddhism and then becoming ordained? How did that?
I think with most people here, it brings kind of a different perspective. Instead of growing up into a traditional Buddhist family where you're dragged to the monastery when you're a little kid, made to offer things to monks and nuns or whatever, a second reflex, it allows me to question, what's this about? Allows me to look at it from more of a something that I can connect with, something more of kind of a almost like a empirical. Or scientific inquiry, Every step of the way, I ask myself, is this bringing me more peace? Is it bringing me stillness? Am I benefit from this? If I am, then I continue. And that's the surprising thing about the Buddhist practice was that, I didn't come in with any kind of expectation of result. I was curious. With my first, interaction with a monk, I've said a few times, the only reason I became interested in meditation was that he said, that I could see the future. So being in the banking, I'm like, yeah, okay, that's what I want. But then the other byproduct starts to appear. That, having grown up in the West, the mind is going all the time. Thinking, planning, projecting. And I, generally thought it was, it's not a bad thing to think. It's good, We worship thinking and a good mind, mental agility in the West. All the great thinkers are, written books and you have to read them in high school and different things. So they are, worship thinking. So I thought, oh, it's good to develop a sharp mind, which is fine. But, the sharp mind can only go so far. And that's why you see if you read biographies of philosophers and thinkers, they usually end up, going crazy or being very lonely because sometimes they can't stop the thinking mind, right? So, and learning meditation experiencing the fact that the mind can slow down, the mind can stop, brings amazing sense of peace, amazing sense of contentment that I didn't know existed. Before I thought happiness is always, a career, having, big paycheck, traveling business class, you know, having a new car, and you know, okay, that's interesting, but only for a while. And then, you know, you find a sense of, you know, unhappiness, a sense of discontentment. Because if you feed your craving, if you get a car, you want another car, you want two car. You know, oh, your friend just had a bigger car. Ah, damn, I want that one. And then you get very silly. Even in banking, we start to compare business card. I get my business card, it's like, oh, it's not embossed. Oh, he got a gold embossed card. Oh, I want that one next. Or whatever, silly, stupid things. You know, that's what the nature of the business. You're always constantly competing, comparing with each other. And it doesn't matter how well you're doing. It's always something else to be had. And then so that this kind of craving just, you know, kind of, it made this hole in my chest bigger and bigger, and I couldn't feel it no matter what I did. You know, partying and buying and running, you know, it doesn't work. The relationship, just never enough. I was looking for the next thing. But, you know, coming to monastery, experience just kind of a few moments of peace and stillness. Wow. That was just really earth-shattering almost. Mind-blowing, literally. And that made me very curious about the Buddhist path. And like I said, I was lucky, you know, there's no pressure. And I just approached what's always, you know, yeah, it's just working. And one of the wonderful things I discovered when, you know, investigating different monasteries, yeah, the level of kind of integrity, the level of purity and the intention of the people who came. The monks and nuns, I know, you know, not perfect. You know, we had our issues and problems, but they were trying their best. So that I found that kind of very, very, very touching, very real. And so that just kept me continuing to practice. And in our tradition, you know, it's not a lifelong vows that you make. You become monks, and you ask for the training, and you see the benefit. And then if you're having a difficult time, we have monks who disrobe when they're 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. It's not a problem. You can use the quality, you can use the skills, you can use the training you had as a monk, you know, and you continue to continue your practice. If that's what you find. You're not getting happiness, you're not getting clarity from monastic life, there's no reason to be there if you're unhappy. Or you're starting, you know, kind of break the rules. No point. Better to become a good lay person, a happy lay person, than an unhappy monk and, you know, and a bad monk to bring, you know, disrepute to the religion. Yes, so it's great that we have the freedom to, you know, become a lay person if things aren't going right. If I feel that I'm not getting benefit, I'm not getting happiness. But luckily, you know, living this life for the last 15 years, you know, find increasing level of happiness, increasing level of contentment, a sense of well-being. And that's something that's difficult to find in the world. You find the people running around, that's all they're looking for, some peace and happiness. But sometimes we're not encouraged to look inside, we're also encouraged to look outside, onward. Remember, the path is the dumbest, leading inward, right? Not onward, always inward. So remember that. Yeah, so I find, you know, it's a very beautiful path. And like the Buddha said, like the chanting we did, you know, beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. Right? So there's no rush. Don't have to be enlightened tomorrow. You're still meeting nice people, meeting, you know, having, you know, quiet time to meditate and experiencing, you know, wisdom that increases your level of happiness, that decreases the level of stress and suffering you have in your mind. So no complaints. Okay, thanks for the question. Yes?
In Buddhism, there are different levels and different types of mind. By the same token, are there different levels of wisdom?
One more time, what was that?
In Buddhism, there are different types of minds and different levels of mind. Are there also different levels of wisdom?
I think, yes. You know, we have, you know, different type of inclinations. And there are types, different, yeah. Wisdom is like, you know, depends how deeply you see into it. Sometimes, you know, there's, like, you have a very deep pond. Sometimes you're seeing just, you know, just beneath the surface. But you have a more still mind, you see deeper and deeper. So there are levels of seeing into reality that we can see. Yeah, and so you calm the mind, if you still your mind, then you see deeper into the nature of reality. You see where it is. that we make suffering for ourselves? Where is it that we attach? That we make suffering ourselves to others? And then when you see clearly, that's the wonderful thing about practice. You don't have to force yourself to let go. You don't have to, you know, kind of do any special practice. When you see clearly, letting go happens naturally as a result. Right? So you can't have, you know, an enlightened monk or nun that travels around in a BMW, lives in a big house, has a nice expensive watch. It doesn't happen. You know, because letting go, you see that those things are just, you know, obstacles. Those things are unnecessary for your happiness. That having little is more conducive to meditation. Using more time to a more simple lifestyle is more conducive to, you know, happiness and stillness. Yes, yeah, so you see clearly, you know, in Buddhism, like I said, you know, the other day, you see, you know, a quote-unquote an enlightened monk or nun, and they get depressed and not happy. Impossible. You can't have those things. If you're wise, you let go of happiness. You let go of suffering. You let go of your attachment. You're naturally happy. Thoughts of depression, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of, you know, jealousy, irritation doesn't arise in a mind who's fully enlightened. Buddha didn't have bad days. No, didn't have bad hair days. Didn't have any hair. Yeah, any questions or comments? Yes?
So you did mention that meditation is the only way to gain, to understand wisdom. The question would be, well, in the recent decade, there's been an increase, I should say, diagnosis or attention to a condition known as attention deficit hyperactive disorder. So these individuals tend to be, well, as this name suggests, very hyperactive and rather uncontrollable. So therefore the question is, for those individuals, it's likely very difficult to introduce meditation. It's very hard for them to encourage meditation for them because their state of mind is already, most of the time they're really hyperactive. Mm. So how, for individuals who would likely have difficulty to meditate, how would you recommend them, or what methods would you recommend to slowly lead them to meditation?
Yeah, that's the thing. I think especially into the practicing, into the working world, that we need to expand sometimes the definition of meditation. You know, meditation is just not sitting with your eyes closed and watching the breath. Although that is, you know, what we usually understand it to be, we can expand it. There are different activities that we can do that are also considered meditation. As long as you are in the present moment, as long as you're with the body. So you can just, you know, encourage people to focus more on the body, like, you know, like when they're sitting. What's it feel like when they're sitting? Or when they're walking, just, you know, right foot, left foot, right foot, left foot. You know, so any activities, you know, even when you're bench pressing, whatever, just be with the bench, pushing things, riding bicycle is a good way, you know, with the motion, you know, on the treadmill. So any things that you're moving around that is bodily based, those, if you focus on, you know, what the body is doing, those are different types of, they call mindfulness and meditation technique. Yeah, so introduce them to that. Anything that they are kind of, tell them, you know, focus on your hand. What's your hand doing? Focus on your hand. What's your hand doing? Yeah, little simple things. Just posture. You're sitting, walking. You're sitting, you know, how much pressure you put onto the seat. Yeah, so just introduce, you know, simple techniques of just focusing on the body will help people, you know, ground them into the way of, you know, like a small step towards meditation. And it doesn't have to be for very long. Do it for, you know, 1 minute, 2 minutes, and then you kind of stretch it out slightly longer. Depends. But also sometimes, you know, in these days and age, we do have a lot of kind of some kind of chemical imbalance, sometimes mental imbalance. So, you know, people with bipolar disability or with kind of, you know, schizophrenia, you start hearing voices. Yeah, definitely, you know, take the medication. calm the mind a little bit, and then you can practice meditation. So it's not a cure-all for every mental kind of imbalance we might have. You know, certainly, you know, we find in a monastery, you've been diagnosed with certain kind of mental stuff, that you continue taking the medication, but also kind of supplement it with the meditation where you can. Yeah. But also, I think, you know, notice, you know, it's not a coincidence that as the world moves faster, and you know, with mobile communication, internet, that the level of mental distress, mental disease is increasing, right? It's not an accident. It's because we are, you know, because we are working harder, mentally thinking. And you know, before, you know, you go home, it's like, oh, kick your feet up, watch the TV. But now, you know, 24/7, you're on the phone, they can reach you at all time. And so you're working longer, really, even when you're not at the office, thinking more. So, you know, after all, that tires the mind. A tired mind is, you know, pretty much a depressed mind. You find that, you know, things that usually don't bother you start to, you know, become almost, hard to endure, unendurable, becomes much more difficult. And then you find, you know, because we haven't had the time, quiet time, just to sit, relax, you know, watch the tree grow, cup of tea, now, you know, kind of good quiet time, just to be silent, be still. And then, you know, when your mind's not recharged, just like a battery, it's flat, you can't do anything. Yeah, and then things become major issues. You find that, you know, you're just, you know, in this blue mood, in this dark hole that all of a sudden you find yourself in. And yeah, and it's not, like I say, and sometimes we start to think, oh, it's my fault, I'm depressed, something's wrong with me. But no, it's a natural phenomenon. Unless we learn how to recharge our batteries, how to still the mind, how to invigorate it through stillness, you know, these things will come up. And then we get worse. But it's not a bad thing. Remember, being a good economist, you know, every obstacle is an opportunity to improve. So in the future, I think there's a great demand, really, for meditation. In the future, you'll see there's, you know, will be, they're like yoga studio, there'll be a meditation studio in every corner. Because people will, you know, you can't escape it. You'll find, you know, you cannot miss it. That, you know, you're working harder, faster, longer, you're going to need to be able to slow the mind, to still the mind with some kind of technique. And like, you know, most of you know, meditation is not a Buddhist thing, right? Lots of people do it. Same with yoga. Usually, you know, before yoga is just something, you know, kind of Eastern people do, Asians do, but now everybody does yoga. And I think going forward, same thing with meditation. It's, you know, it's non-denominational. It's just another mental hygiene, mental training. Because we are living in a very fast-paced world, and it's not going to slow down anytime soon. It's going to get faster. And so we will need, you know, some kind of skill to cope with the ever-increasing complexity of our world, which is not a bad thing. You know, with a still mind, we can, you know, do more, clean up the environment, live peacefully. We're more sensitive to each other through communication. We know that, you know, different cultures are not really different. Just our surface stuff, that we're humans inside. You know, we feel, we suffer the same, right? So through this increased sensitivity of watching the mind, of stilling the mind, we can come together and solve any problem. Yeah. Does that answer the question? Sort of. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
My question is about wisdom. There's this quote I really love, experience is what you get when you don't get what you wanted. According to Buddhism, does the cultivation of wisdom involve lots of trial and error, like making bad decisions, making mistakes? Is that the only way to become wise?
Not necessarily. I think real wisdom comes from a still mind, but certainly you can learn from your experience. So wisdom is, you know, many ways, but the day-to-day wisdom, the worldly wisdom is, yeah, you have the mindfulness, you see, but, you know, when I do this, does that bring happiness or suffering? And then you know next time, okay, yeah, I shouldn't yell at my girlfriend, she'll slap me, okay, don't yell at my girlfriend, right? Yeah. So you know, you see clearly, this time I do this, it bring results or not. And then you see, same when you meditate, when you act out of generosity, does that make you, brings you more happiness, or just, you know, brings other thing? Or when you act out of anger, Does that bring happiness? So, you know, so that there is obviously a lot of wisdom to see your experience with that, you know. And Buddhism, you know, it's not a religion in the sense that, you know, just bow to the Buddha and then, you know, you become enlightened. Buddhism is about causality, you know, understanding A creates B, B creates C. When you see that clearly, then you always put in the good causes, putting a lot of care and compassion in the present moment, putting, you know, forgiveness when you interact with people. Instead of putting, you know, jealousy, putting anger, putting greed into your mind. Yeah, so that's what, yeah. So you do have to have the clarity to see. A lot of times, you know, we act out of habit. Someone says something, we say it back. But sometimes we step back and say, okay. I see it in relationship with my boss. Sometimes it's, you know, adversarial. We think, oh, it doesn't have to be this way. The next time he says something, criticize me, I'm not going to get defensive. I'm just going to, you know, let it go. I'll be more mindful when I'm around him. Yeah, sometimes, you know, mindfulness, clarity, you know, help the situation. Yeah, so it is. So wisdom is about, you know, kind of, yeah, being aware of your actions, being aware of the results that it brings. Yeah, so it is a bit of trial and error in that way. Yeah, like, you know, meditation, like, I encourage people to experiment. You don't always do the same thing day after day. You know, do a bit of walking meditation, sit in a different place, different posture, and see whether that brings peace or not. Try a bit of breath, do some metta, you know, just, you know, a bit of chanting. Who knows, maybe you get very peaceful from chanting. So, you know, just don't take anything with face value. Don't have preconceived notions. You know, try it out for yourself and see whether it works for you or not. You know, lots of monks and nuns here saying, you know, this works for me, you should only do this. But we all say that, right? This works for me, only follow the breath. Don't do anything. Don't do any chanting. Chanting is for, you know, come on, novices. You got, no kidding. But, you know, find out for yourself what works or not. Yes?
Regarding one of the spiritual virtue that you brought up, i.e. Determination and patience.
Yeah.
So you were saying that you know, sometimes our mind keeps searching for the next thing. And sometimes we need to be calm and wait till things happen. I guess you sort of get a sense of my question, but say things like, say for students, we are really, you know, career is something, like, for me personally, career is something very important to me.
And yes.
I study banking.
Yeah.
And I want to get a career in investment bank.
Yeah, sure.
And, which is your path before.
Yeah.
And you know how competitive it is to get into such industry. Or not just banking, or maybe any other job. I think jobs
sure.
in general are
very competitive these days. Yeah, that's, yeah, sure.
And, you know, students are trying to differentiate themselves, trying to sort of fight. I think literally fight for the job.
Sure.
And if you don't fight, then I don't know. I think I don't have the courage to sort of stay calm and I'm afraid of being lost, you know? Like,
sure. Like, no one likes to lose, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to lose out. I don't want to be left behind.
Sure.
But so I was wondering, I mean, what am I doing here in the university without, you know, I mean, we study here. Because we want to get a job.
Sure.
We want to achieve and pursue things. Sort of like a part of the self-seeking procedure.
Mm.
But so, is that possible for you to sort of seek things, be a part of the self-seeking, but at the same time achieve happiness and maintain peace, inner peace, whatever way you call it?
Right, so you want your investment banking job and enlightenment at the same time. That's pretty greedy. That's right.
Yeah.
I think there's nothing wrong with looking for these happiness, but why is to remind yourself that really it's not it's not everlasting. Even if you get your job, you want something else, right? You won't be satisfied just with an investment bank job. You want to be, you know, if you get your dream investment bank job, right? Investment banking job, you want to be the manager. You want a big bonus, right? You want to be, you know, the head of the company. So these desires is endless. So keep that in mind, right? So it's not going to bring everlasting happiness because you want something else. But the second thing is that it's okay to want things, but also remind yourself, you know, that for every, you know, things that you want or every job opening you apply to, right? There's hundreds of other people doing the same thing. So remind that you might not get what you want. And that's the nature of the world. Right? So realize that. So it's okay, you can put effort into it, but you know, don't get overly depressed, overly get dejected. You don't. And this is where a kind of determination came in. I remember I was in Bangkok, you know, applied for hundreds of jobs. I said, oh, no, you look Thai, we don't speak any Thai, no, we can't hire you. I work cheap. No, we can't hire you. And I was desperate, like, okay, you know, I need experience. So I'm going to work for you guys, a Thai company, they don't pay anything anyway. I'll work for free to learn up. Still wouldn't hire me. But then, after a few weeks, a few months even actually, I got lucky because not speaking Thai, I can't work for a Thai company. So they said, okay, I'm going to go look for the different foreign companies in Bangkok, looking for workers. And yeah, funny enough, they were looking for a person who has some banking background because the stock market was starting to take off, and someone who can add. So, you know, in the beginning, sometimes you thought the failures actually turn out to be a blessing in disguise, because when you work for foreign companies, they pay much more than the Thai. And they're willing to train me. And I didn't have to learn Thai. I can speak English. Yeah, so sometimes, you know, your initial failures, as long as you have the determination to say, you know, I'm going to keep knocking on doors, really. I'm going to keep knocking on doors. One day, someone's going to say yes. And sometimes you do need that confidence. That, you know, and some determination, those kind of determination helps in obviously the worldly sense. You know, keep knocking on doors until somebody says yes. And sometimes you do have to put yourself, you know, it's like, you know, we all say, yeah, yes, yes, we can knock, you know, we can, you know, pursue, we can be determined. But, you know, when about five people say no on one day, and then, you know, and the next day, more people say no. And they keep saying no, and they keep saying no. You, after all, you lose your kind of self-confidence. But that's where you see, what kind of stuff you made up. So you keep have to kind of encourage yourself, pick yourself up, and keep, you know, continuing the path. Knocking on doors until someone says yes. And eventually, yeah, someone is going to say yes. And that's also the determination that you need to pursue the spiritual path. It's even more difficult because you'll meet with, you know, lots and lots of setbacks. You'll meet with lots of obstacles, lots of confusion, lots of craving will come up. The Mara, you know, the tempters will come up with all sorts of excuses why you shouldn't practice or why you don't have what it takes to continue the path. But it's the same thing, you know, you say, yes, I'm just going to pick myself up. I'm just going to pick myself up and continue to walk this path, no matter how long it takes. So, you know, it's good to pursue what you want in life. There's no harm in doing that. But also, keep it in perspective, you know, that, especially in the beginning, that you're not going to get, you know, your dream job. You might get it, you might not. So just kind of tell yourself, you know, okay, I might get it, I might not. That way, when you don't get it, you're not overly distraught, right? And then and you also say, you know, lots of happy people who aren't investment bankers. they still manage to have a family and go on. Yeah. And it's not what a cracked up is. Highly stressful, right? You hope you're ready for that. Highly stressful. By the time you're 40, you're done. Like, you know, you're out.
Can you elaborate more on your point when you were saying, like, be patient and things will come to you? I mean, it's like a cliche thing. Everyone say that, like, you know, things come to you when you least expect.
It's very cliche. Yeah, no, I know what to do. Yeah.
I don't really buy it, but yeah. It's really hard to comprehend, you know?
It is. It's true, because part of it is we are giving mixed messages as well. On the one hand, you say, I'm being peaceful, but on the other hand, you see all these people running around, and they're kind of getting what they want, and they're winning deals or whatever. Yeah. So it is kind of mixed messages. But I think it goes back to what I said before, was that, you know, I cannot prove it to you, to show you. What you need to do is, you know, to take what I say, and then to apply it to yourself. And see whether it works or not. Maybe patience is not for you. Maybe you should be busting away with 24/7. So, you know, put this into practice and see whether it works. Sometimes you find, maybe I wait. This thing will come to me. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. So be willing to try it out and see. And I think you'll find that, this is where wisdom comes into place as well. Sometimes you do need to exercise a lot of energy, a lot of power, and just to push through certain things. And other times, there's nothing you can do, and you just have to wait. And you have to be patient. So knowing the difference, when to push and when to stand still, that takes wisdom, right? And that you have to, you know, kind of work out for yourself. Yes, yeah, so I'm not always saying, I'm, yeah, certainly not saying, oh, yeah, there's a term paper next week. That's okay. I just said to be patient. I'm just going to sit here and be patient. The term paper doesn't write itself, right? So you know, it's time to exert energy. You know, time for you to do, yeah, do it. Time, you know, to relax, also relax. Yeah, so knowing when is important. And that brings success. Because sometimes, you know, I see people running around, working hard all the time, and then they burn themselves out. And then, there's a big project coming up, things that they should be kind of saving the energy for. They're too exhausted now to do anything. Yeah, so you have to pace yourself, you know. There's time to work really hard. Yeah, work hard. And the time to say, okay, I'm going to relax. Take it easy and wait. And yeah, you have to know.
But ultimately, all the things that you work for, it doesn't equate with happiness.
No, but it's a cliche also for me to say that. Yeah. But you have to know for yourself.
Okay.
And it's true. You know, it's very cliche. Money doesn't have by happiness. But yeah, you know, get $1 million and you'll find out. Money doesn't have by happiness. But I don't know. Yeah, that's the thing. You know, just take these kind of teaching as reflections and offering. And then to put into see for yourself. But also just kind of remember, just keep in the back of the mind, oh, okay, that's what the monks and nuns were saying. Oh, money doesn't have by happiness. Now I get it. Okay, yeah. Or, you know, certain things. Just kind of not to accept, not to reject it, but just to keep it there. And then, you know, when life, you know, you go through life, just, you know, bring these things up. Oh, okay, that's what they're talking about. Because a lot of time, you're not meditating, you don't know what peace, you know, really, how wonderful peace is. You're saying, it's easy for you, though. You don't have a bloody job, right? That's why monks and nuns sit all the time, because they don't have a job. People feed us all the time. I've got lots of time to sit and watch my breath. But, you know, you can try for yourself and see. And then when you do get a peaceful meditation, you're like, that's what they're talking about. That's why they're sitting watching their breath all the time, because it is the highest happiness. Yeah. But like I said, now it's just a concept. It's an idea. But anyway, just keep that. That's the thing. That's why it's an offering. I'm just going to offer it out there to the universe, to you guys. And then, you know, one day, the time is right, it starts to click and then you make sense. Then you can use it. That's why, you know, these talks, you don't have to write notes. Just kind of listen with an open heart. Sit back, relax, allow these to penetrate your heart and your mind. And then when you need it, it'll come up. The time is right, you'll say, oh, okay, that's what he means. That's interesting. Yeah, but until then, yeah. You know, kind of, there's no, you know, a quick fix. Always, in, you know, exercise intelligence. Yeah, think for yourself. Does it work for me or not? Because true, as students, you know, everybody's sitting here telling you, oh, do this, do that. But it's true. All we do is offer it to you. For you to take it and use it. Make it work for you. You know, make meditation work for you. Make Buddhism work for you. Whatever ways you can. Does that make sense? And good luck with your job search. For a small donation, we can do some chanting. Yes?
In his enlightenment, does the Buddha conceive of the birth of the universe and the evolution of life?
No, I think from a classical Buddhist perspective, On the night of his enlightenment, what he did was he went through the four jhanas, and then he reflect on dependent origination, how things come into existence, like how his own body and mind came into existence and the cause of it. And then that's one of them. I think that the first knowledge, they said, was that he remembered his past lives, remembered all the different lives he was, you know, different incarnation he became. And that's where you get awareness come from. Imagine, like, you know, we want to be rich, want to be famous, want to be a movie star, be prime minister, be, you know, powerful, be a sports star. Yeah, because you think, oh, this is kind of cool to be these people. But imagine if you can remember all your past life, you remember being these people already. Being, you know, being that, done that. You know, you're a man, a woman, an animal, a god, everything. then you realize, oh yeah, it's not that exciting, right? Okay, so then you start to, you know, step back from this craving to exist. We all have this craving to exist. That's why we're here. It's not an accident. You know, we're all bought the ticket to ride in the life, the game of life. So nobody here is innocent. We all come here because we have craving. And we'll continue to come back because we want to be here. But if you remember, you can remember all your past life, and it's, you know, it's not a fantasy, it's a clear knowledge, clear seeing, as if it's yesterday, of all the things that you've been here billions of times, you know, why bother coming back? So that's the first knowledge that the Buddha had, remembering. And then he also had the psychic knowledge to see the passing away of other beings, seeing the same thing, the whole samsara, you know, going up and down, being a god, being, you know, a demon, an animal, and all that. And how all beings fare according to their karma. You make good karma, you become a good place. You make bad karma, you go into, you know, kind of lower hell realm. And then the third knowledge is where enlightenment came in. Then he penetrated through, you know, ignorance. And by letting go. Yeah, so that's what. So he didn't think about the universe. That came later. And it's interesting, he said, you know, very famous teaching. He was walking through the forest with many monks, picked up a few leaves in his hand, and he talked to Ananda. He says, you know, how does it compare, the leaves I have in my hand or the leaves in the forest? And it's like, you know, sometimes Ananda must not be very bright, because Buddha also asked him these obvious questions. Ananda's like, of course, Buddha, the leaves in the forest much more than the leaves in your hand. Then the Buddha's just so, Ananda, the knowledge that I know through my enlightenment, it's like the leaves in the forest. But what I teach are the leaves in the hands. Why do I do that? He said, I only teach suffering and the end of suffering. Because the only things he teach is pointing towards enlightenment, pointing towards the transcendence of suffering. He knows, you know, how the universe is, whether there are aliens or not, whether we have parallel things. He knows all that, but he doesn't teach any of that. People ask him all the time.
He didn't say.
It's not helpful. Because it's just, you know, it's not helpful. So I can't say anymore, right?
He knows that because he didn't say it, right?
He didn't say it.
So you can't make the claim that he knows about the origins of the universe.
No, he said he knows. He said he knows.
Or he did say he knows.
He did say he knows.
But he didn't explain it.
No, because he said it's not conducive to your the end of suffering. It's not conducive. At least
a
way.
He's more concerned about a human living being, is it?
He is only concerned with kind of, you know, out of compassion, really, leading us towards the transcendence of suffering. So that's why he teaches, you know, because the monks ask him all the time, you know, Buddha, you know, is there, you know, a universe? What's outside of this? How big is the universe? And, you know, what happens when I die? Where I go? What happens when you die? The Buddha, where do you go? And he said, you know, lots of these questions that people ask. And he says, no, you know, it's not what I teach. I teach suffering and the end of suffering. And everything else is you know, a distraction. Yeah.
So he might not know anything about the origins of the universe.
He might not know. Maybe he's bluffing. I don't know. Questions or comments?
I have a question regarding the karma teaching of Buddhism.
Yep.
Okay, we're not talking about past life and future life and all
okay,
that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I mean, my mom told me that everyone has their own destiny. Me personally, I don't believe that as well. But sometimes I want to believe that because it feels like, you know, sometimes you fail achieving something and you was like, ah, it's just a part of my destiny. It's not meant to be for me. So it helps you move on, you know. But if you put it in the Buddhist perspective, you know, there's cause and effect, there's karma, all that thing. But is that true, though? I mean, is that true that everyone has their own destiny? It's another teacher question, but I really want to find out.
No, in the Buddhist perspective, it's not a destiny in that way. But we come with a certain kind of inclination. Like, you know, you've been this certain way in the past life. So we come with certain kind of inclination, certain skills, you know. Some people are good at math, some people are good at, you know, English or whatever, certain skills that we've done. And that's, you know, that's the Buddhist explanation, like Mozart, right? You think, oh, he's a genius, he plays the piano 6 years old. Well, he's been playing piano the last 100 lifetimes, so of course he gets better at it. So it's the same thing. You know, we have certain inclination we bring into it, into our life. But each moment of your life, you're making these intentions. We have, you know, so there's no clear destiny in that way, that you are steering your life according to, you know, the intentions you have in your mind. Yeah. So let's say you want to be an investment banker, so you steer your mind towards, you know, going to university, you're doing certain things, you know, doing certain courses, and that eventually brings, but that's only a part of the whole picture. The other part of the picture, which you might not have control over, is obviously, there are other factors involved in your career as an investment banker, not just desire. There's a whole bunch of other things involved. So that's why sometimes you can, you know, the life is like, you know, you kind of aim, you can aim. But whether you get to the target, you know, depends on many factors, not just yourself. Yeah. So sometimes, yeah, it's good to have a goal, but, you know, like you said, just remind yourself, yeah, okay, I might get there, I might not. But it's okay. As long as you kind of, you know, do your best, a bit of a cliche, but, you know, try, and then all you can ask for. Yeah. But it is, you know, sometimes, you know, and the good thing is just to learn from your setback. You know, it's true. You know, sometimes when success makes us, you know, and makes us a bit, you know, lazy. But when you fail, you learn so much more about yourself. It's where you see what you're made of. Well, do you have what it takes to pick yourself up off the floor? Do you have what it takes, you know, to continue? And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, that's what, you know, sometimes makes the difference between, you know, a successful person and a person who's just kind of a mediocre person. After a while, they give up. And that's why, you know, sometimes it's good to read the biographies of, you know, different leaders. And you see, you know, their stories of trials and tribulations. And you see that no one has it easy. You know, there are times that you have to exert a large amount of energy. The time that you really have to exert a large amount of, you know, effort to strive. But look around. Nobody achieved their success by themselves as well. Right? There's lots of people that come and help you along the way. Yeah, so you see that, you know, your success is more of a reflection of the people around you. So it's better to kind of cultivate, you know, a group of friends that you can depend on, a group of friends you can rely on. So notice that sometimes, you know, in this, you know, competitive environment, we see, you know, me against the world. Not really. A lot of time, you know, it's more of the factors you set up. A lot of time it has to do with, you know, your friends around you, your family, your support network that you have. And a lot of time it has to do with the goodness that you generate in your past life. Maybe you gave, you know, a spoon of rice to, you know, a Pacheco Buddha. Then, you know, maybe you gave a spoon of rice to an arhat in the past life. And so, you know, success comes without having trying too hard. So we don't know. But certainly, you know, you won't know until you try. And see what you're capable of. So it's, you know, we make our own destiny from Buddhist perspective. There's nothing set in stone that you have to, that you can fulfill, or you fulfill without trying. You know, even if, you know, it's this, every day is the intention, you know, to focus, to exert energy, to cultivate, you know, wholesome qualities, certainly, and also, you know, to kind of whether you get a good career, whether you get a good situation. You know, just to give some attention, some focus on, you know, a bit of happiness, a bit of peace in your mind. And you'll find that, you know, that kind of, that strength and resilience is inside yourself. Then you can cope with whatever things, changes come up. You know that if you're successful, it's okay. You're not so successful, you meet with obstacles, it's also okay. It's time to learn. Yeah, so it's always try to, you know, as a practitioner, as a person, yeah, to learn, to grow, you know, as you go into life. You always learn from the situation. Yeah, it's always something you can do. You know, it's never a thing that you can, yeah, be kind of be a passive kind of a driver in life. Something you can always learn to do from. Even if it was do nothing, then you can learn, you know, okay, now it's time to actually relax and not do anything. Now it's the time for me to exert lots of energy. And that you have to experiment and know for yourself. Yeah, what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah. You were talking about cultivating wholesome action or wholesome intention. How can you define wholesome? Because I guess I don't have the wisdom to see whether my action is wholesome or not, because it's hard to see all the consequences of an intention or an action you conduct.
It's you have to have some clarity of mind to focus. But, you know, sometimes you say, you know, okay, you can set clearly, like, I'm going to spend this hour day, you know, doing some charity work and see what that feels like. And I'm spending this hour day doing other things and see what that feels like. Or sometimes, you know, you get angry and you yell at your friend. Okay, interesting. See what that feels like. And sometimes you say, okay, I'm really angry, really pissed off, but you know what? I'm going to take a deep breath, wait 15 minutes, and see what that feels like. Yeah, that's you can see. So that's why you have to kind of set your mind up. And then you see, you know, when I do this, yeah. Sometimes we just, the problem with most of us is that we just act out of, we react. We don't think clearly. But sometimes, you know, now that you know about, you know, intention and result, then, you know, set it up and see what that feels like.
So that's how the Buddha focused a lot on clearing the mind and through meditation.
Yeah, that's right. Because his mind is clear. He sees this thing clearly and naturally. And he knows, okay, when I do this, A, B happens. You want to change B, you have to change A first. Yeah. Yeah, if you do A, B is going to come. Okay, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That's through still mind to meditation, he saw that. Much deeper level. Yeah. How the mind comes back, how consciousness has a body. Yeah. Through, you know, the craving, through the energy of the mind. Yeah. So when you have a clear mind, you see clearly. Into very deep of, you know, this thing we call body and mind. What is it inside you? What are we made of? Yeah, are we the person we think we are? Sometimes, you know, we have this body, we have this mind, but we don't know so much about it because we're always constantly looking outward. So spend some quiet times. And meditation is a great mirror. When you sit quietly, what thoughts come to your mind? Is it thoughts of kindness, your thoughts of worries, thoughts of anxieties? These are things that, you know, you have underlying your mind. But sometimes we don't want to hear it, don't want to see it. And we distract ourselves by looking outward all the time. By playing on the video games, by going to see shows, by talking to our friends. So we don't spend very, you know, much time by ourselves. We don't spend very much time, actually, in silence. So we don't really know, you know, who is this person? Being an investment bank, is that what you really want to do? Is that going to bring true happiness?
Well, it sounds really cool.
It is. Maybe, but maybe, you know, you never know. Maybe we'll make millions from selling hot dogs on the corner. Think of a new way to, you know, market hot dogs. I don't know. Yeah, that's fine. You just heard that the meditation is a new hot thing. Maybe you'll start set up meditation studios or something. Yes?
Yes, how do you account for the fact that most monks, for meditating for 20, 30 years, they still cannot see the kind of past life the Buddha can see? How do you account for that?
Yeah, I think it you know, like I said, it's based on the kind of past inclinations and skills you have. It's like, you know, people, everybody can swim, everybody ride a bicycle, but we cannot be Olympic, you know, level of competitors. It's the same with, you know, these seeing past life is kind of a special knowledge that's rare. But that's not to say that meditation is, you know, they're still not getting happiness, not getting peace from meditating, right?
They get all these benefits, but they still cannot attain the skill of the Buddha. It's just too bad, is it?
No, but that's not the purpose for meditation, right? The main purpose of meditation is really for calmness, still mind, and cultivate a sense of well-being, a sense of contentment.
Yeah.
So if you're happy and you're content with what happens in meditation.
But if you cannot see the past life, your wisdom has not been perfected, right?
Not exactly. Some people can see past life, but not enlightened. Some people are enlightened without, you know, seeing past lives. So it's not a sure thing. It's certainly a very helpful thing if you see clearly that you've been there, done it many times.
But if you cannot see the past life, that means your wisdom is 100%.
Sure, no, that's fair enough.
So
yeah.
They can never see the past life. Some people have come to the level they cannot go up anymore.
This lifetime, but remember we come back again, so maybe next lifetime they can do more work.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Buddha is one of the very, very few people that can see the past life in his lifetime.
There are monks and nuns who can, certainly.
Who have done so?
Yeah, sure.
And they have published?
Some do, yeah. Yeah, because also, because remember, these are, they're called super special knowledges.
Yeah.
That's not something you want to reveal. And monks and nuns are not allowed to claim in public what they know and see under these special conditions. Sometimes they pass away and then their disciple write books, because, you know, you can tell the monks and nuns about these kind of special knowledges, but you cannot make a public declaration. Some monks do it, not because to show off, but because they want to inspire people to say, you know, these things are still possible and they still can be done. So they do say this, but generally they say it very late in their life. So there are, you know, I'm only familiar with the Thai tradition. So there are monks and nuns who, in their biography, you know, say very clearly, you know, I remember this, I remember that. Yeah, like Ajahn Mahabodhi, when he was alive, you know, made it, you know, because he was so enlightened for so long, he talked about it, as a matter of fact. There was this lady who came, you know, regular visitor to his monastery, he came, and she was taking a bus back that day. He's like, well, you should wait for the next bus. Don't take this bus, wait for the next bus. And then, that bus, you know, had an accident. And they ran into the place that she would be sitting, but luckily she wasn't there. Yeah, so, you know, he obviously, and she said, you know, past lifetime, they had very close connections. So this lifetime, he obviously, out of compassion, you know, steer her away from that. Yeah, so there are people who can kind of see these things. Or I think what it was, he was very strict, and he never took any invitations outside. So one day, he went to do a funeral chanting, which, you know, almost, you know, never, Ajahn Mahabodhi would never do those kind of things. There's, you know, rituals are more city monk. He would never go do chanting for funerals. And they were like, the monks were very puzzled. They're like, Ajahn, you went to do this funeral. It's a bit strange. And he said, yeah, you know, that was my wife. The last 100 lifetime or something. This lifetime, he didn't marry. And he said that, you know, just kind of out of the connection I had with her, I went and do her chanting. And knowing that this is the last time I would chant for her, because he's not coming back. So he would mention these things, you know, kind of to his disciples, and they get published later on. Yeah, so there are monks who, you know, and one of the nice things about kind of being a monk is that you do get to meet these people, and then you do have the closeness to ask these kind of very sensitive questions. A lot of times they would, you know, give you a fierce scolding. None of your business what I see in my meditation. You just watch your own meditation and not worry about it.
My earlier question of levels of wisdom. So if you can see all these things, your level of wisdom is higher than a monk who can't see, right?
Generally, but not. It's hard to classify like that. Because remember, Sariputta was very high in wisdom, and he didn't have any psychic powers. And Sariputta is the Buddha's right-hand man. When whatever Sariputta said to his disciple, the Buddha said, you know, as Sariputta said it, I cannot say better. So Buddha was very, you know, high in his praise for Sariputta. But Sariputta had no psychic power whatsoever. All this, you know, demons came and kind of annoyed him. He couldn't see them. They were making fun of him. He couldn't see them. But he was content. He was like, yeah, okay, whatever. Yeah, so it's not a sure thing. It's a rough correlation, but it's not a sure thing. And then you remember the famous, you know, kind of stories from the Buddha's cousin, Devadatta, had all the psychic powers. He can, you know, impress. He had a king as a devotee, because he impressed the king with his psychic powers. But then he used, because it's his own delusion and greed, he tried to use that and take over the Sangha. He tried to kill the Buddha many times. So if someone has very lots of psychic power, still, you know, can be quite evil if their mind is not pure. Yeah, so we can use this kind of, you know, psychic powers come from a still mind. But if you can make a sense of self and you can be deluded, then you use the power you have, you know, for personal gains. And then that creates a lot of bad karma. Yeah, so that's why I say it's not a sure thing. Yeah, psychic powers. Yeah. Yes?
Is there any conception in Buddhism of your past lives being related to direct, like, ancestry or lineage? Like you're saying, like Mozart in the past 100 lives plays the piano, and that's why it looks so good. Is there any understanding that there is a literal connection to some, you know, great grandfather, great, like, some past life is lived as
they are? You are generally born with the people that you're close to. So you were, you know, maybe your grandfather or your great grandfather in the past life, because that's, you know, you're used to, you're attached to your mother, you're attached to your father, so you get reborn in these circles over and over again. And I think, you know, recently there's more kind of scientific information regarding reincarnation, and they sometimes you have a birthmark and it's related to how you die, So they would, a lot of time kids remember their past life more because they're more innocent and they're not kind of conditioned by, you know, these kind of, they have memories for some reason are more kind of clear. And they would take these kids who had these kind of past life memories. And I think it's called Dr. Stevenson. And he would only write about the cases that he can clearly point out, clearly have evidence. And like, you know, these kids who, you know, like say from a certain village, they said they've never been to another village, but they have memories of this. And then they would test, you know. And they, funny enough, you know, they would go to this village where they've never been to. They know where, which house. They say, I used to live in this house. This is my wife. This is my kid. And they take the picture and they would verify that. So some of those cases are written about. Yeah, but that's the problem with past life because there's no records. It's hard to prove. But occasionally you have, I think a very famous one, they did in the States. I can't remember the channel, but it's on the YouTube somewhere. Just Google reincarnation. And there's this kid who, from very small age, was fascinated by planes all the time. He knew everything about planes. And then he started to describe a certain type of World War II planes and then, you know, the kind of mechanical stuff that he had that wasn't available kind of general knowledge. And after a while, he had all this accident about being blown up an airplane, and they finally verified that, you know, yeah, he was this pilot who was kind of blown up over the Pacific. And then the details that he described was not something that's accessible for a six-year-old on the internet. But, you know, like the names of certain things and where he was, and then, you know, because through, you know, the information that they have at hand now, they can look back. And yeah, he was, you know, they verified that he was this, you know, this pilot who was shot over the Pacific during World War II and died and now came back as a little kid. Yeah. And that was kind of a bit interesting. And something that they can verify. Like obviously, you know, this kid, obviously you have, you know, detractors who say, well, the parents must have coached him. You know, maybe he was watching a show and that, you know, it's kind of stuck. But, you know, they verify with different experts that a lot of things he said, the details he said, but regarding the airplane was not available just through any book. And sometimes, you know, and that just through, you know, research, they found out that he knew so much more than what you can get from a book and televisions and stuff like that. Yeah, so there are a few of those things around that you have to look around to find. And it's true, you are kind of reborn with around people. And it, you know, from Buddhist perspective, makes sense. You know, the reason you're here is because you have attachment. You know, you have, you know, you like your, you know, your father, your mother, a certain thing. But from Buddhism, attachment comes in two ways that you reborn. When you love someone, you're close to them. But when you hate somebody, you also get reborn close to. Because think about it, from a mental experience, when you hate somebody, you know, who you think of all the time? This same person. So remember that. Let go of your hate. Because you'll see them again.
So does that mean you're going to get married with whoever you hate in the fight?
That's right, that's right. So you have a bad girlfriend, make peace with her. Okay. Thank you for all your questions and comments.
Thank you, Ajahn.